Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about the law and counterterrorism. And our guest for the program is Amos Giora. He is professor of law at the law school at Case Western Reserve University. He is also director of the Institute for Global Security Law and Policy there at Case, at the School of Law. He is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana to talk on this subject, Global Perspectives on Counterterrorism. His visit here is sponsored by the folks at the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, also Political Science and the Center for Global Studies. In his academic work, he teaches and develops courses on the legal and policy aspects of counterterrorism. He is the author of the first legal casebook on this subject, Global Perspectives on Counterterrorism, that will be coming out next year, and has published on a number of topics, including rule of law and terrorism, on torture, morality in armed conflict. He's also done a lot of research involved in the financing of terrorism, cyber terrorism, and so forth. He served for 19 years in the Israel Defense Forces, holding senior command positions in the Judge Advocate General's Corps, including legal advisor for the Gaza Strip. He was judge advocate for the Navy and Home Front Commands, and also commander in the IDF School of Military Law. He'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 3 o'clock in room 384 of the Armory Building in Champaign, and I assume that anyone who is interested should feel welcome to stop by and hear what he has to say. And, of course, here on the program, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep moving, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions from listeners are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
One question I thought we might begin with and talk a little bit about. This is something that, at least since 9/11, people have debated and thought about quite a lot. And depending upon how you answer the question, that it's going to have a lot to do with how it is you pursue terrorists. And then what you do with them, how you treat them if you apprehend these people. And this is the central question. Certainly we've talked about it here before and callers have tossed it around with us. The people who are responsible for an event like 9/11, are they soldiers or are they criminals? And as I say, depending upon the answer that you give, if you want to pick one or the other, then you'd say, well, then from that point, then it either becomes a matter of, you know, it's a military matter and you want to pursue it that way, or it's a criminal justice matter. You want to pursue it that way. And we tend to want to say, yes, it's either one or the other. And I think your answer is
neither.
Yes.
I've developed something that I call the hybrid paradigm. And the hybrid paradigm says that individuals such as those involved in 9/11 or terrorist activities thereafter are neither criminals nor prisoners of war. They're not prisoners of war because prisoners of war, according to international law, can only be members of a state. They can be soldiers, and the terrorists are not members of a state. They don't belong to an army. They're not criminals because in the American context, if someone is defined as a criminal, has the status of a criminal, he's entitled to full constitutional rights and privileges and protections. The only way that counterterrorism can be effectively, we can talk about the word effective down the road, but the only way counterterrorism can effectively be conducted is one under the rubric of the rule of law, but also enabling the state to protect itself. One of the primary distinctions between the hybrid paradigm and a criminal is in the American constitutional paradigm, an individual who is brought to court has the right to confront his accuser. Because much of the counterterrorism information that we have is from a source or sources, we need to protect the sources. And the way that I've suggested going about doing that is to enable somebody to be brought to court, and he can be convicted in part based on an intelligence source, somebody he can't confront. So I would call it a criminal law minus. So it's not a criminal law. It's not a POW. It is this hybrid paradigm, something in the middle.
Mm-hmm. This business of trying to do this according to the rule of law and then perhaps asking, having to step back and asking the question, well, what law are you talking about? Have we entered into new territory here, or in fact have legal scholars, people who think about international law, people who think about the law of war, that in fact we actually have been here before and that these questions aren't new.
I don't know if the questions are new or not new, but what is clear is that we are in a new realm where there, the whole concept of a state engaged in combat with a state, I think, is a thing of the past. What we're going to have in the future is states engaged in combat with non-state actors. The term I would use is armed conflict short of war. The law would be domestic law, would be international law, but with respect to international law needs to be revamped or enable states to better protect themselves, to more effectively protect themselves against this amorphous enemy who is not a state, this non-state entity. It is something that is extremely difficult to do because international law, Geneva Conventions, as an example, are deeply entrenched. But in many ways, they're not applicable to the current conflict, which I fear that the current conflict is also going to be the conflict of tomorrow and the day thereafter. And so there are people such as myself who are advocating a rearticulation, a revamping of international law to enable states to more effectively protect themselves. But again, I emphasize, under the rubric of the rule of law.
Mm-hmm. From time to time, this certainly has come up in other conversations, and I think I have heard from many people, people who, you know, calling in, participate in the conversation, who really advocate very strongly this argument that says, again, if just as our case study, we take 9/11, say, these people are criminals, this was a criminal act, the criminal justice system should be able to deal with them. How is it that you would say that doesn't quite do it? How does the criminal justice system come up short in being able to deal with the perpetrators of something like that?
Because going back to what I mentioned earlier, that the criminal law paradigm in the United States, anybody who watches Law and Order and Miami Vice and all those other shows, sees a defendant, a prosecutor, defense counsel, and witnesses. Because of the reality of terrorism is that much of the information comes from sources. We need to protect the sources, and therefore you can't enable the defendant to confront some of his accusers who are those sources. There have been a number of suspected terrorist defendants have been brought to trial in the United States federal courts. One was in Washington, D.C., Massawi. And in many ways, I think that trial probably was not effective in a number of different ways. The idea of Guantanamo, on the other hand, I think is also problematic. And so this paradigm that I've articulated would be criminal law minus, I think I would advocate that there would not be jury trials for a number of different reasons. Jurors can be intimidated. Some of this material, the intelligence information, is extremely difficult to understand if you're not trained in this. So I would, for instance, have a bench trial, meaning a trial by judges only rather than by jury. I would enable the defendant to confront some of his accusers, not all of his accusers. But I think what's critical to note, unlike Guantanamo, is that I would allow clearly for independent judicial review, because whatever decision a court makes, there must be judicial review of the initial detention or the continued detention, and of if there's a guilty verdict, of the guilty verdict also. Mm-hmm. And the idea of detaining somebody without enabling them to have this independent judicial review of his status and of his detention is something that I find extremely troubling.
Ever since 9/11, and again, another of the questions that have been greatly debated, and I'm not sure we have very good answers. I suppose there are some answers. What means are acceptable to extract information from people? And if you do something that even falls within the rules but looks at all coercive, then how reliable is that information?
I think the question you've just asked is the heart and soul of terrorism and counterterrorism. What happens in the interrogation setting between the interrogator or interrogators and the interrogatee ultimately defines who we are as a society. So let's begin with what doesn't work, what's not allowed, and work our way back. First of all, torture is illegal. Torture is illegal according to a 1984 convention called Convention Against Torture. Therefore, we can't torture. And if the United States has engaged in torture, then I would suggest that's a violation of international law. In addition to that, by if you will, outsourcing, by putting somebody on an airplane and sending him to a country where torture is allowed, it's called rendition, also a violation of international law. On the other hand, we need to get information. That's the reality of counterterrorism. I argue that coercive interrogation is lawful, provided that there are two critical provisions in place. One, that the order to impose certain measures on the interrogatee are authorized in writing by the commander, by the head of the security services, and not the decision of a particular individual who's involved in interrogation. And second of all, that the authorization to implement certain measures are in writing. So there will be no more of this wink and the nod, and no more of this amorphousness, because ultimately, if you look at Abu Ghraib, you look at the memos that were written by Jay Bybee and John Yoo, they created this culture, intentionally or unintentionally, we can talk about that also, where ultimately it's all but inevitable that bad things would happen. That's why authorizations need to be clearly in writing, made by the senior individual with a physician on board, and a physician who also assumes responsibility for the care of the individual being interrogated.
Is it necessary to have a set of rules about what you can and can't do that is so specific? And I suppose perhaps the question is it possible to develop a set of rules that are so specific that say you may do this, 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 and this, and not these things, and make it so that there is no chance that an interrogator would say, well, the way that I read the rules, I thought this, whatever I did, fell within the guidelines that was acceptable.
What's really interesting is to talk to interrogators themselves. And interrogators are the prime advocates for clearly written guidelines, because they don't want it to be left more in an amorphous or murky fashion, too much to their discretion. They're the ones who really do demand, if you will, that there be clear guidelines. And I think that clear guidelines can be created. Sometimes the question is then raised, will the interrogatee know what the limits of the interrogation are? And the answer is yes, he does know. Both sides know the rules of the game. The question is, how skilled is the interrogator with those rules and getting the information out of the interrogatee? I think not to have clearly articulated guidelines is nothing but a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the thing that concerns people, and I'm sure that people wonder about it, is they look at a particular case, look at an individual that had been held and interrogated, and it would appear the interrogation went by the rules, that the interrogators did what was allowed. And yet you look at the effects on the individual, and you see an individual that seems to have been so psychologically damaged that you wonder two things. One, again, you wonder about the quality of anything that they might tell you. And then comes the question of, well, what constitutes torture? And if you have procedures that seem to be allowed under the rules, and yet the effect on the individual, it seems to have done so much damage to that person, then how can we say that in fact is not torture?
Right. Well, first of all, the convention I referred to earlier clearly defines what torture is. Torture need not be physical only. It can also be mental. It need to involve severe pain, physical or mental. That being said, society needs to protect itself. How we go about doing that more effectively maybe than we've done to date clearly requires the articulation of clearly defined and articulated guidelines. To be involved in interrogation, either from the perspective of the interrogator or the interrogatee, is not necessarily a pleasant experience, but the information must be elicited. But the interrogator can't cross this magical line, which is, as I say, articulated in this convention. Because the moment you cross that line, you are therefore not only in violation of international law, but because the United States is signatory to this convention, you are therefore in violation of American law. One of the important things to note in terms of torture, not only is it physical, I mean, there are mental acts that you can cause mental suffering that, frankly, are just as egregious as physical pain. I mean, I don't need to touch you, frankly, in order to torture you.
Hmm. Is it being realistic to think that we can get useful information without coercion? And if we say that we don't want to do that to people, then are we saying that fine, if you say that, that's, you can say that, but then the result is that if we're interested in getting information that can be used to prevent future acts of terrorism, then we're going to, in a sense, be limiting our ability to do that.
First of all, in many ways, we are limiting our ability to do so. Maybe the best articulator of that is the just retired president of the Israeli Supreme Court, Barak, who developed a theory called self-imposed restraints, meaning that civil democratic society imposes on itself self-imposed restraints. Is there a coercion involved in the interrogation process? The answer is generally yes. But I argue that there's a fundamental difference between coercion and torture. How you go about developing, articulating, and implementing, there's no doubt that it's something that we need to address as a society. There's no doubt that if you speak to interrogators, they will tell you that they really do need to have articulated limits. I think most interrogators understand exactly what torture is. Interrogatees also know what torture is. But there's a difference. There's a valley between, or gulf between, torture and coercion. We need to get the information, but we also need to guarantee that the interrogator his basic rights. And international law is very clear on that. For instance, waterboarding, which has been referred to a number of times in the media and evidently has been performed by the United States on at least one detainee, is, according to international law, torture, and ergo a violation of international law, and something that the United States can't do. Other measures are allowable, again, provided that there are guarantees and under strict supervision.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Amos Giora. He's professor of law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law, where he is also director of the Institute for Global Security Law and Policy. He teaches and writes on various legal and policy aspects of counterterrorism. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk. He's here sponsored by the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. We'll give a talk this afternoon on the campus at 3. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here on our line number 1 in Champaign. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I just wanted to ask, I mean, this is a very, very interesting and difficult problem, but one thing I'm wondering is, this returns to this issue of what's new here. I'm wondering if our response is not what is primarily new, insofar as if we consider historically the Contras. Of course, the United States government supported the Contras indirectly as well as directly in their guerrilla efforts. In Nicaragua. And I'm wondering if you have a way of distinguishing between, let's say, Contras, or for that matter, the Viet Cong, and these so-called terrorists in our day. Because if you take 9/11, they were supported by the Taliban, which was a nation state. And it seems that even now, the Bush administration typically accuses Iran, for example, and Syria of supporting, quote-unquote, terrorists in Iraq. And so I'm wondering if it's not our response that's new here, because there have, as you've noted, been laws on the books. There were, of course, war criminal trials in World War II in Japan and Germany. At this point, of course, what I'm wondering is if this is not what you're advocating, even though it seems that you're not as extreme in your advocacy of the way to deal with these folks as the Bush administration. Is this not, for example, these trials that are conducted at Guantanamo, kind of post-legal, also, of course, coercive, as you say, but if not beyond coercive, a kind of show trial? And the one example I just wanted to bring to note is Hicks the other day. I was looking online, and I saw when he said that he was guilty in the evening, and I read the New York Times, and I read the Associated Press report, and I noted that the Associated Press made no mention of something very, very important that happened at the trial, which was that unexpectedly the judge said that his two of his three lawyers would not be allowed to sit in the trial. And this was in the first day of the trial, and so he promptly admitted his quote-unquote guilt by 8 p.m. that night, which suggested to me it was a kind of show trial, and suggested that the Associated Press, for better or worse, was not even reporting basic facts of the trial. So I'm wondering whether we're throwing away habeas corpus and many other things in a new way when the fight itself may not be so new after all.
All right. Well, the caller raises a number of points. You can respond to how are you.
First of all, I must say you raise a number of truly critical points in terms of this debate. Let's begin with this. There are hundreds of possible definitions of what terrorism is. So I'm going to posit what mine is, and we can use that as a point of discussion. I argue that terrorism are acts committed against innocent civilians, be it their deaths, their injury, or property damage to them, for the sake of a cause. And I have identified three causes: religious cause, political cause, and social cause. But what's important with my definition, you don't have to agree with my definition, but what I suggest is the emphasis is the attack on the innocent individual. I don't know enough about the Contras, and I'm a firm believer, if I'm not an expert on something, I won't go there, I just don't know enough. In terms of what makes this form of terrorism new from past forms of terrorism, is first of all, terrorism is not new. I mean, terrorism has been around for thousands of years. What is different, and I think what we need to be deeply concerned about, are, in particular, are the suicide bombers who are attacking truly innocent people, willing to kill as many of them as possible. That's what makes this in many ways different, is the random killing of, obviously, of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. How we go about protecting ourselves is the critical question here. With respect to Guantanamo, I don't think it's a show trial. I mean, these people are defended. I don't know who Hicks's three lawyers were and why the judge forced two of them out. I don't know enough about that. But there clearly is in Guantanamo today a process whereby the defendant is allowed to be represented. Initially, the representation was not by a counsel of his own choice. Today, to the best of my understanding, you can be represented by a counsel of your own choice, along with a JAG attorney. There is no doubt the JAG attorneys who are representing the detainees in Guantanamo are doing a truly extraordinary job, and they deserve the nation's thanks for that. What's critical to understand is that as we go forward with this, we're not in a vacuum. The bad guys are out there, and the bad guys would like to kill us, but simultaneous to that, we need to respect their rights. We need to understand that the rights of the individual are paramount, along with the rights of the state. And we need to develop a response to this new paradigm while simultaneously protecting ourselves. And that, frankly, is what makes this so very difficult. In terms of my, if you will, my own political, not my political, but my stance on this, I'm a firm advocate that rule number one of counterterrorism is that terrorists have rights. But I immediately add that the society has the obligation to protect its citizens. How we go about balancing, how we go about responding to the balancing dilemma is probably the most important question that all of us need to be thinking about on a daily basis, because that really does define who we are as a society.
Does that call, or does that get at your question?
Well, I mean, it's a difficult problem, as you, of course, note. I still just wonder, it sounds to me like the degree of success at killing civilians seems to be the primary difference that you're talking about here, that in other words, the Contras and others were clearly killing civilians, as we know, in many cases. And this, of course, the effectiveness of the guerrillas starting, especially in the Gaza Strip and so on, I really wonder if we're following the sort of a legal approach, for example, of Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians, that we are sort of creating an American version of this kind of almost post-legal approach to what is obviously a terrible issue for society and for governments.
I would just, if I can just make one more point here, I don't know what the expression post-legal means. The issue of effectiveness, for instance, to conduct counterterrorism effectively, does it mean that we have to be respectful of the rule of law? We have to be under the rule of law. In addition to that, there's a whole new area of discussion in the field of counterterrorism, which is called morality in armed conflict, which is something that sounds murky. But you cannot, I argue, cannot conduct counterterrorism unless it's done in a moral way. What does that mean is one of the most difficult questions, having been involved in teaching and training 19-year-old junior commanders in the Israel Defense Forces. The issue of morality in armed conflict has become supremely important because if we conduct ourselves immorally, there's always the fear of cycle of violence and blowback. So I don't know what post-legal means is, but I do know that anybody who's involved in counterterrorism, be it from a policy perspective, a legal perspective, an operational perspective, must understand that it's all about the rule of law.
Well, I certainly appreciate the comments of the caller. We have somebody else who is standing by. We're already at our midpoint. I want to go on and also invite other callers. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's another caller, also Champaign. It's line 3. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. I think I have a different view of the legality of what's going on in Guantanamo and how much real access those detainees have to genuine legal representation. But what I really am interested in going to is what you earlier were saying about coercive means of interrogation. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with the work of Alfred McCoy. He's done a lot of research into torture, and one of the very important things that he found was that physical torture is not nearly as damaging as the psychological torture methods that are used. And so I guess I wonder how you parse out using coercive means of interrogation that don't cross that line of psychological torture.
Okay. First of all, I'm not acquainted with Mr. McCoy's work, but as you mentioned his name, I wrote it down and I will look at his stuff. I argue that there are five measures that fall under the rubric of coercive interrogation. And I will tell you what these five are, and then it obviously always leads to debate as to whether or not, how far can we go with these. One, I argue that the interrogator can be sleep deprived. The Geneva Convention talks about requiring somebody to have 8 hours sleep in a 24-hour period. Nowhere does it say that it has to be eight continuous hours. So you can break up those 8 hours or those 16 hours. Two, I argue that the temperature of the interrogation room can be modulated, but here the but is important, that it's under medical supervision. Three, I argue that the individual can be placed in a room where there's loud and cacophonous music, again, under the rubric of medical care. And I think when we talk about these measures, and I can't emphasize this strongly enough, what's really important here is the medical attention. Two other measures. One is that he can be placed in an uncomfortable chair. That, too, is what is called a stress position. And the fifth one is that a hood can be placed over his head. Not consistently, not constantly, but what the importance of all of these measures are the following. One, it introduces to the interrogatee that the control factor, because ultimately what interrogations are all about are controlled by the interrogator over the interrogatee. But I can't emphasize strongly enough, and I appreciate the fact that some of these measures sound harsh. I appreciate that. What is critical is that the authorization to use these be given by individuals who are going to be held accountable for the implementation of these measures and if anything happens to the interrogatee. What torture ultimately is all about, and you're right, be it physical or mental, maybe mental is worse in terms of causing psychological damage to the individual, is it's a system run amok. And we saw that obviously in Abu Ghraib, where there the torture was out of control, total failure of command control. And in the system that I articulate, in the paradigm I'm trying to articulate and develop, there is very strong command control. What's important to remember is that the interrogatee, when he's arrested, detained, he understands the rules of the game. He knows the rules of the game, and he knows that he's not going to be offered a cup of tea and a biscuit. He understands that he's going to be subjected to certain measures. These five measures that I've articulated have also been suggested by others will enable the state as much as possible to push the detainee, the interrogatee, without crossing into that horrible area called torture. The obvious question that I've been asked over and over again is, what about the ticking time bomb exception? If you talk to interrogators, most of them, if not all of them, will tell you that there is no such thing really called the ticking time bomb exception, because the chances of arresting that one person who knows exactly where the bomb is and where exactly when it will go off and so on and so on is not a truly viable scenario in the context of counterterrorism. What intelligence gathering is all about is putting together a jigsaw puzzle based on interrogating person A and then B and C and D, and trying to put the jigsaw puzzle together. Interrogators will tell you that if they need to lay a hand on the interrogatee, then it's a lost cause and they have lost. It is all about the ability of the interrogator to elicit information from the interrogatee in a very skillful fashion, using a variety of, if you will, of psychological ploys, which are legitimate. It's an extremely difficult aspect of counterterrorism. We have no choice, and I appreciate your question very much, sir. We have no choice whatsoever but to ask ourselves the hard questions, because it really does define who we are as a society, while we also simultaneously need to protect ourselves.
Well, I hope you do look at Alfred McCoy's research and ponder that in terms of, you know, what you find to be acceptable and not acceptable. But I think we're on a very slippery slope, and the Bush administration has certainly slid into the muck. And when you use these kinds of methods against people who have been vacuumed up by the Bush administration, many of them who have been shown to not, you know, been any kind of terrorist at all, I think that it's not just a moral question. I think it's a criminal matter, and that a number of people in the administration need to be prosecuted themselves. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there would be people listening to the conversation who would hear the kind of methods that you described as being acceptable, those things. And if they would think about trying to imagine what it would be like to be tossed into a room that was cold, where they kept the lights on, where you couldn't sleep, and where they were playing heavy metal rock music to you 24 hours a day, and that was seemed to be completely open-ended, like you never knew when it was going to end, and that maybe also in your mind you would think to yourself, well, yes, there are certain things they're not supposed to do, but how do I know that they're not going to do those things? I'm sure that there were people who, imagining themselves in that situation, would say that's torture enough. Now, maybe that's being sloppy with the word. But who exactly decided that those things were acceptable? Who drew that line between what you can do and what you can't?
The matter has come up before a number of courts. It came up before the Israeli court. It came up before the European Court of Civil Rights. Those of us who are in the business of trying to articulate the limits of power, which is ultimately what this is all about, understand that the interrogation dilemma is all about how to balance. Is it pleasant to be in a room with the music and that it's cold? Well, first of all, note also that the interrogator is also in the room with the interrogatee. So he's also subjected to what you call loud heavy metal music. Believe me, it's worse than heavy metal music. He's also there. In addition, in the paradigm that I've articulated, because of the existence of independent judicial review where the individual is represented by a counsel, and this is something that occurs in Israel because it's a part of the Israeli system, is the individual comes before a court and tells the court to make his case as to what he's been subjected to. And courts have clearly, depends how you want to look at it, interfered or intervened in how the interrogation process is conducted. I can't emphasize strongly enough the importance of independent judicial review. And if one is going to look back, for instance, here in the United States, post-2001, I argue that the United States Supreme Court has been hesitant to intervene in the executive decisions. The late Chief Justice Rehnquist had written in a book earlier that in times of armed conflict, the courts are to be reticent. I think, with all due respect to the late Chief Justice, I think that sends a terrible message, because an executive who knows that the court is going to be reticent may allow himself certain excesses. And I think that an unfettered executive with enormous discretion is highly problematic. And American history, unfortunately, tragically, is replete with examples of what happens when the executive is unrestrained either by the Congress or by the courts.
Well, to date now, do you think that there has been sufficient judicial oversight?
No.
Still no? You're shaking your head. Still no?
No. I think here in the United States, we're a long way away from implementing what I've called active judicial review. If you want to use this on a spectrum, the Israeli Supreme Court is the most active commanders in the idea, and Israel Defense Forces know that whatever decision they make, whatever operational decision they make, will be challenged by a petition filed to the High Court of Justice. The petition will be filed in real time while the commander is actually planning or about to implement a particular act, and the court will hear that petition in real time. Real time being, if the petition is filed in the evening, may hear it in the evening or may hear it in the following morning. From the commander's perspective, he must take into account the possibility that the court will interfere. That is active judicial review.
We have other callers. They're all in Urbana. Next, we'll talk and we'll take them in order. We'll take first line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd like to sort of take off on the last caller. This is my big question. My understanding is you are merely dealing with the point at which the prisoner comes and the interrogator has to deal with him. But as the previous caller said, when there are these large sweeps, there are many people who are, one, innocent, or two, they are so peripheral, they really have absolutely no intelligence to offer. It seems to me that having better intelligence, obviously, would lead to better results, but that these people, when they are eventually released, and of course all the time while they're incarcerated, whether it's Guantanamo or in Iraq or Afghanistan, the agony of their families and the media and et cetera, that it creates a kind of a backlash. And in fact, I'm just, this is just my question. Do you think that it may in fact create more terrorism? In other words, vengeance, revenge, where people have been innocently, you know, tortured or treated so badly that it sort of turns them.
You raise a number of very important issues. First of all, the whole issue of who have we detained and why have we detained them, and have we engaged in what great movie Casablanca, Round Up the Usual Suspects. It's clear that individuals were detained in Afghanistan initially who there was no reason to detain them. I don't think there was a sufficient vetting process mechanism instituted whereby we could truly understand who we had brought. Is there always the chance for blowback? That's what you call, what I called earlier, the cycle of violence. Sure, if somebody's been subjected to humiliation, there's always the chance that he or she may realize or come to the conclusion that they need to take certain actions down the road that, for instance, would be defined as terrorism. The answer is there's always the chance that somebody who's been subjected to humiliation, for instance, is going to engage in blowback activity. But the larger question is here is what you referred to rightly as intelligence information leading to the interrogation. I think it's pretty clear that in the immediate aftermath of the American invasion of Afghanistan and then of Iraq, we clearly did not have sufficient information on the ground because we didn't have sources, we didn't know the languages, we didn't know the culture, we didn't understand the clans. So I don't think there's any doubt that we arrested people, detained people who we had no reason to detain them. You bring them to Guantanamo, and then you start interrogating, and you realize there's nothing to be gained from their interrogation, and then you release them. The requirement to establish a mechanism where, A, you know who you're detaining, and then, B, how you go about determining whether or not they continue to present a threat to American national security is something very difficult to do, and there we clearly need to improve our basic on-the-ground intelligence gathering, all in many ways based on our insufficient language skills and our insufficient understanding of local culture. You're absolutely right.
I mean, for example, people in Guantanamo who were picked up in places like Pakistan because there was a bounty offered, you know, to pick people
right.
up, that in fact still haven't been released, or they're released to a country which then proceeds to torture them for whatever right. imagined crimes they may have committed. Or in Iraq, I'm sure there are personal vendettas, sectarian vendettas, where people can merely, you know, tell on someone, sort of like a Salem witchcraft trial, and it seems that the intelligence is so gullible that those people can just be rounded up. I mean, I even wonder sometimes about Palestinians. It seems, okay, this one last question. If a person, for example, if someone's like really sort of really tough and they're like in some cell and they do terrorism and whatever, it seems to me that those are the people that are probably going to be pretty tough in torture, like they expect it. They're, you know, you could probably do, I don't know, maybe you could do anything to them and they wouldn't break. Whereas other people that are have no experience or things like this, they would be breaking pretty fast. I don't
know. Yeah, you want to, can you respond to that?
First of all, torture is illegal, immoral. And at the end of the day, the other thing to note about torture is that torture does not lead to actionable intelligence because the individual who is being tortured will tell me whatever he thinks I want to hear in order to have me stop torturing him. So torture is ineffective. Not only is it illegal, immoral, it's also ineffective. But going back to your question about who we rounded up, whether it was in Pakistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, and who knows where else, I mentioned earlier, and we'll move on to other callers, what's critical here is that we have a far more developed intelligence-gathering apparatus on the ground, which really does come back to languages and understanding local cultures. Because also from the perspective of the interrogator, if you have somebody who's not in a position to give you any information, in terms of misallocation of resources, that's something that needs to be seriously considered, because he's wasting his time rather than talking to somebody who can give him important intelligence information.
We have a couple of other callers. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Amos Guiar. He is professor of law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. It's in Cleveland. He's also director of the Institute for Global Security Law and Policy there. He's visiting the campus. We'll give a talk this afternoon. His visit here sponsored by the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. We're talking about his particular area of interest, and that is the legal and policy aspects of counterterrorism. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm beginning to think that that our counterterrorism efforts are always going to be imperfect, and that almost no matter what we do, there's going to be blowback. Is there any way to design your counterterrorism effort so that you don't end up making people even more angry and somehow creating more terrorists?
You mentioned that I'm writing the world's first casebook on this this field, so I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. In the immediate aftermath of the Madrid train bombing in March of 2004, in the eve of the Spanish national elections, the newly elected government, which was elected after the train bombing, withdrew Spanish forces from Iraq. That had been what the terrorists were getting at. There was near universal condemnation of the Spanish government for withdrawing from Iraq, because the Spaniard government was accused of acquiescing in the face of terrorism. Here we are 3 years later, and to this day, from 2004 to 2007, there has not been a non-ETA or Basque act of terrorism in Spain. Does that mean that Spain's policy decision was effective or ineffective in terms of avoiding blowback? In spite of the near universal condemnation, to date, it's been proven effective. Is that something that is recommended for other nations dealing with terrorism? It's an open question. But what is important to note, I mean, there are arguments going back and forth, but it's an interesting model. Other nations, be it Russia in particular, Israel, and the United States, when faced with daily acts of terrorism, what's important to know when we talk about terrorism, it's not the one time. 9/11 is not the traditional model of terrorism. The traditional model of terrorism is the day-in, day-out grind. Those three nations, Russia, Israel, and America, respond to terrorism. If you particularly look at the Russian and American and Israeli model, is there always that if you're going to operationally engage the terrorist or the terrorist supporters in counterterrorism, to some extent, you can clearly argue that blowback may well be inevitable. The question of how much blowback, it's an interesting question. I think that most states who face daily terrorism have reached the conclusion that they occasionally need to respond. Do you respond to every act of terrorism? Absolutely not. And there are all kinds of studies on this that show that again, we don't really know how to define effectiveness in counterterrorism. But if you're going to try to be effective, however we define it, that responding to each and every act of terrorism is, I think, clearly ineffective. You lose any kind of deterrence power you may have. You also are going to, I think, have a greater chance of engaging in or contributing to collateral damage. You also may lose your sense of proportionality. So you need to pick and choose your spots. So I don't know if the Spanish model is relevant to other nations. Responding to each and every act of terrorism, I think, is also an ineffective model. And what it all comes down to is trying to balance the various dilemmas while also identifying who the terrorist is, who his supporters or her supporters are, and engaging them operationally. It is, I should add, having been involved in this for 20 years, the decision of when to respond and who to respond against and how far to go in the context of international law and morality is extraordinarily difficult.
Let's take another caller. This is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Did I understand you to say 15 minutes ago or so that there were certain stress interrogation techniques that you approved of that should only be done with medical staff standing by?
Correct.
In my mind, that is torture. And I don't want anyone to do that on my behalf. If the interrogation is that close to the line, I think by any reasonable understanding, that is torture. If you have to have a doctor standing by, and I can't imagine that any medical personnel who take their professional ethical obligation seriously would be an accomplice to that sort of action. I think it should be basis if a doctor participated in such a thing, they should lose their license to practice. I'm just appalled at that thought.
No,
I think that, first of all, I truly appreciate your candor, sir. It makes I think it's important to have open discussion on these issues, so they're not going away. We're stuck with this stuff. The importance of having the physician present, from my perspective, is not what you defined as an accomplice, but rather to ensure that harm is not done to the individual. And if the physician feels that the individual, the interrogatee, is at harm either psychologically or physically, then he has the authority to stop the interrogation. So he's not a passive accomplice. I think exactly the opposite, sir. He is an active intervener. And I think that's the importance of having the physician present. He's not there passively. He's there very actively with very significant line authority to intervene and to stop the interrogation. And if the physician tells the interrogator that in his medical opinion, psychological and or physical damage may be caused to the interrogatee, then the interrogation will stop.
Are the doctors who do this, by and large, are they military physicians? Are they active military people?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. But again, for instance, in the Israeli model, as a judge advocate general, when I was involved in various counterterrorism measures, if the judge advocate general would say to the commander, no, then that in the Israeli model means no. Because there is, in at least how the role of the judge advocate in Israel, there's enormous independence that we have, judge advocate generals. And commanders, like it or dislike it, have no choice but to implement what the lawyer says. It's a little bit different from the American model, where the JAGs are under the command of the commanders. In the Israeli model, the JAGs are not under the command of the field commanders, but are under the command only of the judge advocate general, which gives people such as myself and when I was in the IDF, very significant independent powers.
I guess my reason for asking the question is just the question about the whether a physician in this position would feel independent enough, free of coercion himself, herself, to be able to say to the interrogator, stop.
He needs to he or she needs to feel sufficiently or needs to be sufficiently independent. They're under the Hippocratic Oath. And their ultimate responsibility is to the welfare of the individual. I think that's why I disagree, sir, with your word accomplice. I think they have the required to have independent powers.
I want to try to get at least one more. We're very short on time, but at least one more here in Urbana Line 3. Hello.
Hello. I'm really disturbed to hear your definition of torture and the way you discount aspects of treatment like sensory deprivation, stress position, sleep deprivation as not being torture. I really truly believe that these are aspects of torture, and that when you talk about not approving of torture but approving of these methods, I think you're playing a verbal sleight of hand. These are methods that do lead to mental breakdown and permanent disability, and so I don't know how you can discount them as not being torture. I mean, you talk about it not being pleasant. I mean, that's kind of dismissive of the true effects of these methods.
I don't mean to be dismissive, but I think that the 1984 Convention on Torture, which talks about in terms of severity, be it mental or physical, to be in a stressed position or to have this unpleasant music is, I think, substantively on every different level, significantly different from waterboarding. Waterboarding, I don't know if you know what waterboarding is. Waterboarding is when I simulate your death by tying you down in a gurney, having somebody physically much stronger than you pour water into your mouth until you vomit, and when you are convinced you're going to die. That's torture. That is very different than modulating the room temperature. Is modulating the room temperature pleasant? I don't mean I'm not being dismissive or not being flippant. Is it pleasant? No, it's not. On the other hand, please note that the state has no alternative but to gain or elicit information from an interrogatee who may not necessarily want to give that information. How we go about drawing the line, what we say to what yes and to what no, is, I think, as I said earlier, I think probably the most important issue of the day. We need to protect ourselves. We need to protect, and sometimes we need to protect ourselves from ourselves in terms of maybe violating rights. There is no doubt, though, that we as a community, all of us, have an absolute requirement to engage in very open and frank discussion on this issue.
Is this something, as courts have thought about this, have they responded at all to public opinion or public pressure? Because I would think that there would be a lot of people who would be very, very sympathetic and would articulate the kind of viewpoint that, that some of our callers have had.
Sure.
And they would want to say to somebody, well, you know, X technique, maybe you don't think that that's torture, but I think that that's torture.
In 2 minutes, in 1994, the Israeli Supreme Court, in the late 80s, the Israeli Supreme Court had allowed additional measures, in particular something called shaking, where the interrogator could physically shake the interrogatee. After an interrogatee died in 1989, the Israeli Supreme Court reversed itself in a very important decision that was heard in 1984, and the decision came out in 1999. There was a significant cutback or reduction in terms of the measures that can be used. Are the courts sensitive to public opinion? Probably. Are the courts sensitive to their own sense of consciousness and morality? Absolutely. Do courts need to constantly check themselves? Yes. Do courts constantly need to check the executive? Absolutely, yes. Do we as citizens in these civil democratic societies have a requirement to, on the one hand, to be critical of the executive? Yes. Do we also need to ask ourselves, how do we go about protecting ourselves under the rule of law? The answer to that is also yes. This is a debate of enormous significance. It is extremely complicated. Everybody has an opinion, and I can tell you, I've been honored to appear on a number of shows like this. This is the issue that constantly comes up because people are truly struggling to come up with a definition that, on the one hand, enables them to protect ourselves as a society, and also something that, in terms of their sense of morality and consciousness and political opinions, this is going to be the ongoing debate. It's not going away. I think what is important is to make sure that the executive understands there is political opinions out there, political pressures. But what's really important is to have the Supreme Court and the Congress play a much greater role than they have played to date.
Yeah, we'll have to leave it there. Our guest, Amos Giora, is professor of law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law, where he is also director of the Institute for Global Security, Law, and Policy. He's visiting here at the campus. We'll give a talk on the topic Global Perspectives on Counterterrorism, sponsored by the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, this afternoon at 3, room 384 of the Armory, on the U of I campus. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.